It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get analysis on the major trial involving Google's search engine dominance as federal regulators attempt to crack down on big tech. But first, when Waukesha residents turn on their tap, they'll soon be drinking water from Lake Michigan. The water withdrawal is the first approved by 8 Great Lakes states under a landmark deal that largely bans diversions outside the basin. As Danielle Kading reports, it took more than a decade to make it happen.
It's late August, and construction is ramping up at the site where Lake Michigan water is being piped in from Milwaukee.
So we're going to head over to the pump station now.
That's Dan Dukniak. He's general manager of the Waukesha Water Utility. A pump whines in the background as he leads the way to two pipes. One is light blue and carries water from Milwaukee. The other is dark blue and sends water to Waukesha's system. Dukniak says the whole transition will take several weeks before around 72,000 people have Great Lakes water as part of the $286 million project.
But I'll just be happy for the residents of the city of Waukesha because they've been waiting for a long time for a sustainable, safe water source.
In some western states, access to fresh water from sources like the Colorado River has become a fierce competition. And in some parts of the world, large lakes have nearly dried up over decades due to climate change and water diversions. Those trends have made the Great Lakes an invaluable resource. And in the 2000s, the 8 states and 2 Canadian provinces bordering the lakes created the Great Lakes Compact to protect them. Under the deal, Waukesha is the first city to receive approval from all 8 Great Lakes states to withdraw water. The landmark agreement bans water diversions outside the Great Lakes Basin with limited exceptions. Waukesha fits that bill because it lies in a county that straddles the basin line. Democrat and former Wisconsin Governor Jim Doyle says Waukesha's plans were controversial while the compact was being written.
But we really had to give everybody the assurance that there would be a process, both the sides that wanted the withdrawal and the sides that didn't, by which you could be assured that the water would be returned and it would be treated.
Doyle chaired the Council of Great Lakes Governors when the deal was signed in 2008. Waukesha first applied for Great Lakes water 2 years later. But one of the city's early requests to withdraw up to 10.1 million gallons of water per day was opposed by environmental groups. Molly Flanagan is with the Alliance for the Great Lakes.
It was much more than they were using at the time.
Flanagan says they also questioned whether Waukesha had explored other alternatives. Groups also had concerns about the size of Waukesha's larger service area, and they worried about effects on the Root River, where water will be treated and returned to Lake Michigan. Peter Annan says changes ultimately limited the area served and the maximum withdrawal to 8.2 million gallons per day. Annan authored the book The Great Lakes Water Wars. He says any governor could have vetoed the diversion under the compact, and at least one considered it. In the end, a council representing 8 Great Lakes states unanimously approved it in 2016.
Whether you like the Waukesha decision or not, you can't deny that it's extremely historic for the Great Lakes region and especially historic for the Great Lakes Compact.
A group of Great Lakes mayors feared its approval would open the barn door for more withdrawals, but both opponents and supporters agree it's a relatively minor diversion for the Great Lakes. At a recent ribbon-cutting ceremony, Waukesha Mayor Sean Riley and Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson toasted the completion of the years-long effort with a glass of Milwaukee water.
To the healthy, clean water for Waukesha for generations, and to Milwaukee Water Works, which we'll be drinking. Cheers.
Cheers.
As Waukesha celebrates, Annan says the strength of the compact means it's unlikely water-starved western states will seek Great Lakes water. But he says he wouldn't be surprised if the next request came from water-stressed areas of southeastern Wisconsin. Dan Dukniak with Waukesha's water utility says he doesn't think the city's diversion will be the last.
I will say this, you know, I think the precedent that we've set with returning 100% of the water and committing to that is a precedent that can't be undone.
He says the diversion sets a high bar for any future diversions in the Great Lakes. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a major federal monopoly trial underway, centering on Google's dominance in the search engine industry and what are the stakes for Americans and life in Wisconsin. You can join the conversation along the way about Google's antitrust trial. Call in with the question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Rebecca Ha Allensworth is an antitrust law professor at Vanderbilt Law School. Rebecca, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So the Justice Department, the trial underway, testimony underway. We should note Madison hosts one of Google's 32 American offices with nearly 200 employees. What are you watching for in this trial?
There's so much that's interesting about this trial to a law professor.
Like yourselves.
Exactly. And really, as you pointed out, it should be interesting to everybody. This is a product that literally every single American uses virtually on a day-to-day basis. And for many of us, many, many times a day. So this is a very high stakes trial. For me, I'm looking at, is Microsoft, so a different case from 25 years ago and maybe the last major antitrust trial of this scope, is that case as precedent going to hold up as a blueprint for how to bring modern tech monopolies to heel? That's the way that we've been talking about it for a while. It's the way the Department of Justice views that case, Microsoft, and this is a test of that theory. So that's one thing I'm looking at.
So that last federal big tech monopoly trial targeting Microsoft, what are the parallels there in that case from 2001?
So in that case, Microsoft was accused also of monopolization. Mm-hmm. And the way that they monopolized the market that they had huge market share in, which at that time was operating systems, Windows. I mean, I say at that time, but actually they still have huge market share in operating systems. They were accused of using that dominance and protecting it by essentially destroying competition in another market, in the market for browsers. In particular, they targeted a competitor called Netscape. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that if Netscape had a toehold in the market, that could, for various technological reasons that are now sort of passé, but that could have toppled their dominance in the operating systems market. And the similarity here is that the way that Microsoft did that was they sort of cut off avenues of distribution for Netscape by setting their own product as the default. And that's essentially what the government is claiming Google is doing now by paying Apple and other distributors of their product, their search product, billions of dollars a year in order to be the default, the kind of primary product that you see and use on your computer, on your device. So it's a very similar theory of monopolization.
Looking at the timing here, Justice Department officials first started building this case against Google during the Trump administration. I was reading the complaint, and it says Google's anti-competitive scheme spans nearly two decades and continues to the present, end quote. Why is the trial happening now?
So that's a great question. I think there's a few different answers all working together. One, and perhaps the most obvious, is that priorities have changed when it comes to enforcement of the antitrust laws against big tech as a matter of politics, as a matter of a recognition of the harms that these companies that we once viewed as sort of purely good, you know, hugely innovative, massive leaps in technology, kind of the darlings of Silicon Valley. A lot more has come out now about the potential harms to, you know, consumers in ways that we perhaps hadn't recognized from these platforms, and also kind of a lack of innovation that we've seen from these platforms. So priorities have changed. And what's interesting, as you point out, is that it's changed across both parties. It's a bipartisan consensus that antitrust enforcement needs to be stronger against these tech platforms. Another thing, go ahead.
No, carry on.
So that's the most obvious. And then the other thing that's changed is just that monopoly has lasted for almost two decades. Mm. There's a point at which That's the harm. You know, it's all well and good to be big and great for maybe a few years, but the harm does get worse the longer you stay in power.
When you say, you know, harms consumers, can big tech, a large company like this, even though it's paying, say, a telecom like or you know, Apple or someone, can they still do damage to consumers even if they don't raise their prices on us?
Very much so. So this is another thing that I think is really interesting about the case and that I'm watching for. Search is something that we call a zero price market. In the sense that we don't pay in dollars and cents when we use the search product. But increasingly, we're realizing that you very much do pay a price. You pay a price in terms of your attention, and that is costly to you and very, very valuable to Google in the form of eyeballs that they can resell to advertisers. And I think antitrust has started to realize that that is consumer harm. There's a case against Google from about 15 years ago where the court actually said, no price, no problem. This is not an antitrust issue. And I think that's wrong. And I think a case like this is going to put that kind of precedent to rest.
Rebecca Ha Allensworth is an antitrust law professor at Vanderbilt Law School, helping us to understand the Justice Department's landmark lawsuit against Google underway. Be part of the discussion at any point, calling in with a question, adding your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It could be the biggest case against big tech in decades. We examine the complexities of the Justice Department's antitrust case against Google and how it could change the internet in the future. Call in with a question. Bring your thoughts to the discussion. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Rebecca Ha Allensworth, an antitrust law professor at Vanderbilt Law School. Rebecca, you know, we're hearing the analysis, the statistic batted about that more than 90% of the global search engine market belongs to Google. And their president of global affairs, Kent Walker, says its market dominance stems from the quality of our products rather than monopoly control. How do search engine alternatives compare to Google?
So it is true that, you know, as much as I would love to use an alternative, being somebody who is in favor of competition, I always use Google. And I think that's because it is a better product. However, that's not the end of the analysis. Google wants you to think that that all of its dominance, therefore, is because it's better. In fact, it's better in part because they have made it impossible for other search engines to get in front of enough customers to get the data that they would need to build a viable algorithm that could compete with Google. So it's kind of a vicious cycle or a virtuous cycle if you're Google. The more consumers you have, the more data you have, the better your product and the less likely people are to switch. And then if you cut off the avenues for consumers switching, you can just reinforce that kind of ratchet.
So that kind of returns to your concern around innovation, that the dominance could be stifling internet search innovation?
Yeah, the principle of the antitrust laws going back to 1890 when we, you know, created the Sherman Act is that competition creates a kind of incentive, a kind of push, a drive to build something better in order to attract consumers and to outdo your competitors. And along with that philosophy is the idea that a monopolist will eventually stop innovating in ways that a really competitive company that's facing a lot of competition might. And I think that you see this in the search space. Google has been slow to develop to take on AI. And I think part of that has to do with their long-term dominance.
Google being the default search engine on products like Apple iPhones, Justice Department says default deals contribute to its monopoly power. What do you see there?
Well, this is one of the interesting things about the case that's a little bit different from Microsoft. So I said that it was similar to Microsoft in the sense that both are about defaults. But actually, what Microsoft did in the 90s was even stronger in terms of keeping other products off of computers. Here, Google hasn't done those same kinds of technological ties that make products incompatible with Bing. But they're really doubling down on this idea that the default is strong, that we are ultimately all kind of sheep and we go with what's downloaded on our computers. And that position of being the default is very powerful. And so I think that we both have 20 more years of knowledge about how powerful defaults are. That will be in favor of the government making their case that this is a de facto exclusive dealing contract. And you have some different facts that are that Google is going to make a lot of hay out of by saying, hey, competition is just a click away. This is not like the Microsoft case.
Right, just a click away, maybe a couple clicks. iPhone users are free to change their search engine from the default to any option they prefer. How is that true?
I take their word for it. I don't know. I have not heard that that's not true. I haven't tried it myself. And I think that that kind of speaks volumes. And what I expect is going to happen in this case is that they're going to put on evidence that shows that consumers do not switch, that consumers just use Google. If it's on their phone, they use Google. And that fact is something that in law we would say cuts both ways. Google is going to say, yeah, because it's better. And that's why they don't switch. That's evidence that Google is a better product. Competition is about delivering value to the consumer. That's what we're doing. And then the government's going to say they don't switch because defaults are sticky. And that's how we know that this is a de facto exclusive dealing contract and how we know that a company like Bing has no shot if nobody ever switches.
Rebecca Ha Ellensworth with us, antitrust law professor at Vanderbilt Law School, as we talk about the economic holding power of tech companies and the trial against Google underway. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Rebecca, in 2020, our Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joined the federal antitrust lawsuit against Google. Now we see 35 states and including territories now part of the suit. What role are state authorities having in the trial?
Well, there's two things a state government can do. Well, I would say three. One is just to add kind of force and power to the federal claim in the sense that this is not just a federal issue. This is not just a Biden administration initiative, or I should say Trump administration, because this started under his tenure. This has support among lots of different governments within the United States. They can also add different claims, and in this case they did. So, you know, different states prioritize different theories of harm, different ways that Google was acting, so they can do that. And then the other thing that they can do is not so much adding to the suit, but adding to themselves. So they will be claiming, you know, some sort of relief for their state, and that can potentially be different from what the federal government is asking for.
So when this case is settled, when the verdict comes in, say the federal government wins, would Wisconsin receive trial or would receive compensation?
You know, I don't know that they've asked for that in this case. Okay. Looking at the complaint, it's very vague about what they're asking for. Hmm. One thing that's kind of interesting about the antitrust lawsuit system in the U.S. is that the whole remedy stage is separate, typically, is separate from the liability phase. And while your complaint has to be very particular, especially now, about what the harm is and what your theory of the case is, you don't have to be very specific about the remedies. And so we know very little about the remedies. But theoretically, in other cases where states join in, they can ask for relief. I'm thinking, you know, for example, of the lawsuits against Purdue, where there's a federal angle to it, and then the states sue as well, and states can get money for settlements against Purdue.
Who might be called to testify over the course of this trial?
So you're going to hear from a lot of economists. I think we have already heard from Google's chief economist.
Yes.
But we're also going to hear from expert witnesses in the form of economists and professors that are not affiliated with Google per se or any of these companies. That testimony will be, I think, pretty pretty dry. You know, it's a good lawyer that can get a dramatic moment out of an economist. but we could maybe see some of those. And then there's going to be a lot of CEOs and people involved, other kind of executives, people involved in these competitive decisions at Google and related companies. You know, Apple, for example, tried to quash the subpoena, and that did not succeed. And so we'll be hearing from somebody from Apple about the nature of their decisions and why they made them.
Vanderbilt Law School antitrust law professor Rebecca Ha Allensworth, our guide to the major antitrust trial underway involving Google, the dominance of its search engine. And there's room to talk. Call in with a question and share what's on your mind at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine what is ahead for the search engine giant Google as federal prosecutors seek to prove that it eliminated competitors and paid them billions to hold onto massive market share. What do you think the future of the internet will be? Call in with a question. Add your thoughts along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Rebecca Hall Allensworth is an antitrust law professor at Vanderbilt Law School and stays with us. Rebecca, Statista cites that Google made over $224 billion in ad revenue last year. How are advertising payments different in antitrust cases versus a company that makes products that people buy?
So this is really interesting, and it makes the graphs that I draw on the board when I teach antitrust a lot more complicated. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking a lot about this, and one of the differences between the Microsoft case, for example, is that this market is, the way it's monetized is totally different. So for Microsoft, it was a little bit simpler and more straightforward. You've got your Windows product that people want. It has to go on a computer, and consumers buy that computer. And so you could think of it like Microsoft is selling or licensing Windows to a manufacturer of a computer, and then that computer company resells the product bundled together to an end user. The money flows in that direction as well. So if you're a manufacturer of a Dell, you need to buy access to Windows, and then you resell it to your consumers. In this case, it's almost as if Google is buying something from Apple instead of selling Apple its software. So Google is buying eyeballs, buying attention, buying that time that we spend looking at that black square, and then reselling it to advertisers. And so that puts it at a different point in the distribution chain. And that also means that they're paying for a product that they're reselling, as opposed to just selling a product that goes on to be resold. And that's definitely the way Google wants you to see it. They're saying that these payments, we're not buying market share, we're just sharing our revenue with one of the other actors in the stream. Antitrust the cases aren't really paying attention to this as much as the more traditional distribution kind of patterns.
So if Google would call witnesses like AT&T and Samsung and T-Mobile or, you know, these telecoms, what will it try to present there to defend its agreements with, you know, on mobile devices?
Well, I think that the device manufacturers will be painted by Google as sellers to Google. Google is competitively trying to buy from them a placement on their phones. And, you know, presumably so was Bing or DuckDuckGo or another kind of search engine was trying to buy access. And they lost out because at the end of the day, Google had more money to offer to pay for the product, you know, to pay for that. And that's because they have so many advertisers. They have so much advertising revenue. They just have more to share. And if markets work, it's that revenue is valuable. Like, one thing we know about the internet is that people like to buy stuff on the internet. That's a major source of money. The advertising works. You know, we buy the stuff that we see advertisements for. Why shouldn't they share that with the companies that give them access to those eyeballs? That's the way they're going to paint it.
What effects could this trial have on the tech industry, other tech giants like Apple and Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook's parent company, Meta?
Yeah, so like so much. I think this is so important. This is a real pivotal moment for this new push to have more enforcement against big tech. You know, I think it'd be too much to say that if they fail here, the whole project is dead. But I think if they win here, I think it could do a lot for the attempt to bring these tech companies into a more competitive environment. One big thing is this idea of zero price. So somebody like Meta, whose product, at least to end users, is free, is going to be paying very close attention to how the court thinks and talks about zero price markets and consumer harm in those kinds of markets. I think that could be a big effect. And then another is this idea that Microsoft is this blueprint, you know, this 25-year-old blueprint, will be relevant to all the platforms in terms of how courts will see leverage and other things that big platforms do. So I do think it's relevant to all the companies we've been talking about.
You know, I'm thinking here about the trial and what might happen in the courtroom and how much perhaps proprietary information could come out of witnesses. I wonder how much do you think could be ultimately redacted or sealed from the public view as this goes along?
I think we have already seen, I could be wrong about this, but I think even just in the 2 days of testimony that we've seen, there's been some redactions in what's shown in the courtroom. Hmm. And I know that in the filings leading up to this point, there's been a lot of redactions. I've had to chuckle to myself. Sometimes I download a document from the docket and it's just black, you know, it's like pages and pages of black. So I think we can expect to see some redactions, both in what's presented in live testimony and also what's filed. But at the same time, I am sure that there will be new and interesting information about how these markets work. They are, now I'm kind of doubling down on the metaphor, but they are kind of a black box. And I think that we will know at least slightly more about how these products are distributed at the end of this trial.
Rebecca Ha Allensworth with us, antitrust law professor at Vanderbilt Law School, as we look at the Google antitrust trial underway and the economic power of tech companies. You can join in the conversation at any point. Call in with a question and share your perspective at 800-642-1234. In terms of AI, search engines like Google and Microsoft's Bing are testing the use of artificial intelligence. You said earlier Google a bit behind to enhance search engine results. What effect could AI have on the balance of power among search engines?
Well, AI is obviously a huge disruptor, a technological disruptor to this space. And I think that that's as it should be. And you know, people say, well, this case may be irrelevant because of AI. And I couldn't disagree more. I think the presence of AI and the possibility of real competition is the reason why we need antitrust to make the competitive environment possible for entry, for new ideas and new technology like that. So, you know, all kinds of things lead to competition and lead to change. One of them is changes in technology. And another one is the regulatory environment. And to me, those things have to work together. They have to both be functioning to optimize the kind of innovation that we want to see out of our markets.
Has our regulatory environment been predictable and functioning in recent years? What do you see?
No, it is not, in a word. I think it's been predictable. It's predictable that the large companies that have a lot of network effects, you know, something that lots of people use, and the more people that use it, the more valuable it is. So thinking about Facebook, thinking about Google, they just get bigger and bigger and stronger. And very little has been done by previous administrations to enforce the antitrust laws against them. That has led to an unhealthy competitive environment. And in some ways, this lawsuit is like 10 years too late. I don't know if the government wins, I don't know that that will restore much in the way of competition. I think that in this particular case, Google's gotten so big and so dominant that even if these contracts with companies like Apple and Mozilla are a part of how they got there and how they protected it, it's now about so much more than that, that it will be hard to topple those.
This summer, the Federal Trade Commission lost a case attempting to block Microsoft from buying the gaming company Activision Blizzard, and Wisconsin-based Raven Software is an Activision subsidiary. Where is the Microsoft deal now? What can you tell us there?
So I think that it is being worked out in England. So essentially, you know, so many different jurisdictions have power to block this merger. And what ended up happening is the US tried to block it. And as you say, they essentially failed. The EU said that they could go forward. And then the British Competition Authority said they couldn't. Hmm. And they said that, and then the case was lost in the US. And the EU or the UK authority seemed to sort of back down a little bit and say, well, okay, we blocked this merger, but if you restructure it, you know, we're listening, we're listening. And my understanding is that that's still ongoing, but the conventional wisdom is that the British authority is going to let them merge with some probably relatively minor changes to the deal.
You know, more high level here, are European and Americans moving in different directions on big tech antitrust?
So, no, I think that what's happening is you're seeing more of an alignment of the U.S. priorities with the European priorities. So that's a little bit of a complicated example. But by and large, for the last couple of decades, Europe, the EU, has been more critical and more likely to enforce antitrust restrictions on tech than the U.S. One kind of wrinkle is that the EU's major way of enforcing these things is through fines. And so while they have been more likely to fine liability, they have, I think, been less successful in actually stopping the behavior. Some of these tech companies treat these billion-dollar fines as just a price of doing business.
Vanderbilt Law School antitrust law professor Rebecca Ha-Allensworth providing us context on how the internet could change for Americans as federal prosecutors take on Google. And there is space for your perspective. You can email your question, your ideas to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Justice Department argues Google illegally maintained a monopoly for over a decade, and we learn how a federal antitrust trial outcome could affect our digital lives in Wisconsin. And you can be part of the discussion with a question, sharing comments, email ideas@WPR.org. Rebecca Ha-Allensworth is an antitrust law professor at Vanderbilt Law School and is our guide. Rebecca, Apple this week reveals its latest iPhone model adopting universal USB-C chargers instead of its internal Lightning charger, and the switch comes at the demand of European regulators. What strength does a government's regulation have over international companies like Apple?
Yeah, I think that's a really good illustration of how global these markets are and what that means for the power that one regulator has. You know, as I said, the UK Competition Authority held up a merger. So, you know, one, not even Europe, but just one kind of country held up the merger between these companies. So yeah, it's an interesting question, and I don't know how to resolve it. There's been a lot of criticism of the idea that the US has been coordinating with foreign regulators. And yet it would seem to me that that's kind of necessary in a world in which these products are so global. So that's something that we haven't really figured out a good answer to.
How much does public opinion matter in antitrust suits and in the regulations against tech giants?
Oh, that's such a such an something I've been thinking a lot about, because I would have said 10 years ago, none. You know, I went into this field and people had no idea what it was. And it was this sleepy little, you know, the basic goals of antitrust were sort of a consensus, a kind of a technocratic economic efficiency standard. And there was very little enforcement, laissez-faire. And now it has risen in the public imagination, and it's now something that news outlets are focusing on, like yourself. And so now I would say a lot. It's really changed in the last decade that public opinion matters, because people have started to realize that their own welfare, their own pocketbooks are implicated in this kind of policy, but also things like their privacy and their mental health are caught up in, are we going to regulate these markets? And so now I'd say it matters a lot.
And now you have a generation that has grown up on, you know, Gmail and YouTube and you know, Google searches and the Google Cloud. It's really kind of part of that fabric of interacting with the internet, if I could say that. And I'm just wondering then, what is at stake for users as we go about our lives?
So that's right. I think Google has become basically synonymous with the internet. Mm-hmm. So I actually had a conversation with my son yesterday. He was hearing me talk about, you know, the Google lawsuit, and he's 8. And he said, oh, Google, that has iReady, right? And iReady is some app that he's using at school.
Sure.
But I think his vision, his imagination was, you know, Google is the internet, and everything he uses on the internet is a part of Google. And there's a way in which he's right. And I think there's a way in which that's a big problem. And if that's true, if it's true that Google, if we're going to accept the idea that Google is synonymous with the internet, then it may be time to recognize that it is just totally infrastructural. It is now more like the highways. It is something that everybody needs to have access to, and it stops being treated like a private competitive company. That's been a big push in the academy to think about internet platforms this way. And I think that in some ways, one way to view this trial is one last gasp at the idea that no, we can have competition in these spaces. And so we'll see. We'll see.
I wonder then, but if we accept that premise that these platforms are everywhere for everyone, then it suddenly starts to think about, you know, do they become a piece of the government, or how do we, you know, where do they stop? How do they regulate? You know, where do people go for jobs? It opens up a can of worms.
That's right. So, you know, it's a can of worms, and yet it's a can of worms that we have routinely opened up and dealt with in the history of our country. So if you think about something like roads or railroad, these started out as innovations by private companies acting competitively, excuse me, and then they reached a point of networked dominance where, you know, there really could only be one. If the only efficient version was one, you want to have a coordinated highway system, railroad system. And the government started putting more and more regulations on them to the point where, yeah, it's almost kind of quasi-state run. The problem with that, I mean, there's downsides to doing regulation like that. Excuse me.
It's okay. Take your time.
There's definitely downsides to it, and there's costs to it, but there's a lot of real value that can come from that too. It's just a balance. And I think there's nothing wrong with saying, if you're going to do something totally innovative and take a big risk and create something like a great search engine, you should get some sort of prize at the end of that in the form of being able to monetize it for a period of time, not forever. There's no reason to say that we need to incentivize it by giving you a forever monopoly. And at some point, regulating it more directly, more intensely by the state is something we do have precedents for. It's not really antitrust. That's the thing that I think is a little bit hard to understand. Like, antitrust really is about competition between private companies. And I think that saying, well, we need to have some sort of more direct sector-related regulation here is appropriate, but it's not really the same thing as antitrust.
Rebecca Ha Ellensworth with us, antitrust law professor at Vanderbilt Law School, our guide to the economic power of tech companies and the Google trial underway. You can email ideas at WPR.org to share a question or a comment. Rebecca, Google is developing a program for eliminating third-party cookies on its Chrome browser, and the move would consolidate user data in Google's hands for more targeted advertising. How could this affect Google's market control?
It could significantly affect it. I mean, we know that targeted advertising is a huge part of what's so valuable about advertising, and we also know that it can have some pernicious effects on consumers. This is another example of where regulation may need to be layered on top of the competition questions. Are we going to allow targeted advertising in its current form, in its strongest form, is a question that I think legislators should be thinking about. But yeah, the more revenue that Google has to share with companies like Apple and Mozilla, the more it's going to reinforce its dominance. And so this is all a part of the ratchet effect.
I wonder what life is like in your classroom right now as this trial is underway. Is it part of the conversations of you and your students?
So the funny thing about this is I have been teaching this case for 3 years because I actually taught the complaint when it came out in 2020.
You did.
And I had a representative from Google actually come speak as a guest speaker in my class.
Wow.
So we've been debating these things for years, and I just think it's such a thrill to see it come to the limelight like this. And I will say that I taught this class on big tech, and I invited all of the big four representatives to come speak. And Google was the only company that did so. And I just really respected their willingness to come and speak to a bunch of, you know, students and a law professor presenting their side of the argument. And I thought that I disagree with him. I'm rooting for the government on this case, but he was very convincing and made a lot of really good points. And so, you know, that's just a classy move.
Are your students rooting for the government in this case? What have they said in our last few moments we have
you
together?
You know, I always try to encourage alternative viewpoints, but there's a way in which I think students tend to sort of migrate towards what the professor is saying. But no, I heard a lot of counter arguments as well. I mean, the idea that they are sharing revenue with various distributors of their product along the supply chain, that's a good argument in some ways for what these payments are, as opposed to payments for monopoly.
Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Ha Ellensworth is an antitrust law professor at Vanderbilt Law School. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.